U.S. President Donald Trump gave a former terrorist a bottle of cologne in the White House this week. That's far from the only gift that he was giving out. America's government shutdown ended, and President Trump wants to give out $2,000 stimulus checks to every American. But can the U.S. afford it, or is the nation going to run out of cash? Well, that's also a question many people are asking about Vladimir Putin's Russia. Are they about to go bankrupt? We're going to look at all of these questions and more on today's Trumpet World. Wanted, Ahmed Al-Shara, reward $10 million. That was America's view of Syria's president just a few years ago. And this week, he's in the White House with the president, receiving gifts, having the president joke about how many wives that he has, and generally the two of them getting on fairly well together as far as we could see. What is behind this massive shift and where is it leading? Well, we'll start today by hearing from our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, as you mentioned, Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara visited Washington in an audience with President Trump on Monday. This is the first time a Syrian head of state has ever done this. And you mentioned the bottle of cologne he was famously given. You can see the video online. But there were a lot bigger things President Trump gave him as well. That same day, the U.S. government lifted his terrorist designation on him. He also, or at least the U.S. government, announced that Syria that day will be joining the coalition to defeat ISIS. This coalition, international group, was operating in Syria, but didn't actually include Syria until now. We talked about this last week as well. The United Nations lifted its terrorist designations over Syria as well, with U.S. backing. And also just the optics of being the first Syrian head of state there, sitting with President Trump in the Oval Office. He was being offered news interviews and Fox. It really helped significantly normalize his image. Why is President Trump giving the president of Syria so much? Well, this is a clip from Mr. Trump's press conference in the Oval Office. This is clip one.
He's a very strong leader. He comes from a very tough place, and he's a tough guy. I liked him. I get along with him, the president, the new president of Syria. And we'll do everything we can to make Syria successful, because that's part of the Middle East. We have peace now in the Middle East, first time that anyone can remember that ever happening. And, Syria is a very big part of the Middle East, very important part. If you look back at Syria for years, they had the doctors, the lawyers, they had so many of the great intellects. It's an amazing place with great people. And we want to see Syria be successful along with the rest of the Middle East. So I have confidence that he'll be able to do the job, absolutely.
Now, a disclaimer, Ahmed al-Shara is not Bashar al-Assad, who we ousted last year. Most of those designations were because of what the Assad regime was doing. So you could understand why the U.S. government want a review of those. But is it really accurate to say that this new government in Syria has brought peace to the Middle East, that we could all take a breather from atrocities happening in this part of the world now? Of course not. Obviously, there are a lot of nuances and how much President Shara himself is implicated in these actions is hard to tell sometimes. His control over the country is a bit more tenuous than it sometimes appears. But what we just heard is not the only thing that President Trump said in his press conference.
We want to see Syria become a country that's very successful. And I think this leader can do it. I really do. I think this leader can do it. And people said he's had a rough past. We've all had rough pasts. But he has had a rough past, and I think, frankly, if you didn't have a rough past, you wouldn't have a chance. He gets along very well with Turkey, with President Erdogan, who's a great leader. Erdogan's a great leader, and very much in favor of what's happening in Syria. We have to make Syria work. Syria's a big part of the Middle East, and I will tell you, I think it is working and really well. We're working also with Israel on, you know, getting along with Syria, getting along with everybody.
Rough past. That's a bit of a euphemism to say he, as we've covered before, but used to belong to Al-Qaeda. Joined Al-Qaeda as a young man in 2003 to help them kill Americans in Iraq. He later moved to Syria to fight the Assad regime. Assad obviously was not a nice guy, but these guys are basically ISIS before ISIS. They recruited foreign fighters from all over the world, even as places far away as China, to come in and bring jihad to the Middle East, to bring an Islamist revolution to the Middle East. That's why the men under him that are now forming the government, that are now forming the army, that's why they signed up for his cause. Technically, his group split ties with al-Qaeda in 2016 because of the bad optics, but I mean, a jihadist is still a jihadist. People signed up for what Ahmed al-Shara was offering because of what he was offering, because they believed in his vision. Even if the current Syrian government claims it's drifting away from that, it wants to turn a new leaf, nobody that joined his cause because they were fighting for freedom and democracy. And that was even really apparent in what we saw, even just surrounding the White House as President Shara was visiting. You could notice the B-roll we're playing here. It's crowds of Syrians living in America, greeting him as he's coming in for this historic moment, and they're shouting, Allahu Akbar, God is great. The battle cry so many Muslim terrorists cries when they blow themselves up in an infidel land. And you could see him right in that footage. He's smiling, he's waving, he's greeting the protesters back. Those people saying that know exactly what they mean when they're saying Allahu Akbar at the White House, and I'm sure President Shara, the symbolism there wasn't lost on him either. It reminds me actually of in 1987, there was a famous incident where President Ronald Reagan was having a press conference in the White House with the Taliban, with all these men with turbans and long beards sitting beside him. Back then, the Russians were fighting in Afghanistan and the Taliban were the resistance movement that the U.S. was supporting. And President Reagan was making a big deal about how this is bringing freedom to Afghanistan. This is the real will of the people fighting against godless communism. America helped bring the Taliban into Afghanistan. Less than 15 years after that war concluded, it was the Taliban with al-Qaeda, with the group that President Shara belonged to, that started the 9/11 terror attacks, that sent two airplanes into the Twin Towers in President Trump's hometown. So even just with looking at these physical circumstances, you would think the current U.S. government would have at least a bit of trepidation in making peace with these jihadists in suits and opening up Syria for an American alliance, for bringing Syria into the fold of nations.
And I think there's a couple of takeaways here. I mean, one is I'm struck by the similarity as well with this story that we've seen this week, with more corruption being uncovered in Ukraine, some pretty big corruption scandals involving the justice ministry and people right at the top. And I don't think that surprises many people. Ukraine is well known for being corrupt, just as Russia is very corrupt. But this is where playing geopolitics man's way, relying on your own military ability, or if you're not willing to put forwards, understandably, the effort, if you're not wanting to sacrifice your own men and your own families, your own people dying in foreign conflicts, you end up relying on allies. And then you're going to end up getting in bed with all kinds of unsavory people. And like you say, there's, in some ways, you just have to do that if you're relying on yourself, if you're relying on man. And in some other ways, though, there's quite a lot of this that is naive, that okay, even in that position, you would have thought we'd see more clearly what we were getting into. But this is a long, long story. 1949, just as the Cold War is getting started, Herbert W. Armstrong wrote that while trusting gullible Uncle Sam always seems, in 1949, just as the Cold War is getting started, Mr. Armstrong wrote, but while trusting gullible Uncle Sam, always unable to see more than one enemy at a time, has been busy worrying about Russia, the real menace has been making diabolical and rapid headway undercover in Europe. I mean, this is always the way that America has operated, and so often the friend of today becomes the enemy of tomorrow. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda being a perfect example of that. The Soviet Union during World War II, only to become the enemy in the Cold War, is another. This is what happens when man relies on himself. And yet in this same story, we also have a massive signpost pointing to the only true hope for America and the solution and how to go about this world not getting your hands dirty, not having to do grubby deals with terrorists or with corrupt officials. Because this is also a story that really does point to God's involvement in international relations. And the idea of saying, well, America should depend on God instead of making alliances, instead of even relying on its own military might, that in itself would sound to most people, I think, even more naive than doing a deal with Syria's leader. But this story shows how practical that is, and it demonstrates God's power in world events, because this rapid change in Syria is something the Bible directly and clearly forecast. And because of those Bible prophecies, this is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote. He forecast this event decades ago. It's on the front cover of our September 2012 Trumpet print magazine, How the Syrian Crisis Will End. A very bold statement. And he said, the eyes of the world are fixed on this explosive hotspot. Bashar Assad will be ousted shortly. But then what? You can actually know the outcome. And he went on to describe exactly how the Bible made clear that Syria would not be allied with Iran and would instead be allied with Turkey and ultimately then with Turkey's partners in Europe as well. So this shift shows God's hand in world events.
Yes, I believe that prophecy you're referring to is in Psalm 83. We go there often. It's a coalition of Middle Eastern nations forming in this end time. Verse 4 says that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. That's speaking more than just the state of Israel in the Middle East today. It's also talking about the United States. We have our free booklet by Mr. Armstrong, our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, on our website that can elaborate on that more. And verses 6 through 8 details which Middle Eastern peoples were a part of this alliance. No such alliance has ever happened in history or in the Bible or otherwise, which is why Mr. Flurry, our editor-in-chief, points to this being a prophecy for now. And specifically, it mentions the Hagarenes, the ancient inhabitants of what is Syria today. And because of this, Mr. Flurry, and through other related prophecies, like in Daniel 11, ties this in with Syria is going to join this alliance of countries that are considered moderate Arabs, moderate Muslim countries, and Europe. And because of that, we've expected the radical regime of Bashar al-Assad and his Iranian alliance to fall apart. And for something like this to happen, we have our trends article that we could put in the show notes about why we watch an alliance between Arab nations and Europe that discusses this in more detail. But when you think about blotting out the name of Israel or blotting out the name of America, having such an intense hatred for everything the name of the country stands for, I mean, the 9/11 terror attacks is something that pops into mind quite readily. All these Middle Eastern terrorists halfway around the world from America. America wasn't nearly as involved in the Middle East like it is today. The forever wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq and elsewhere hadn't begun, even happened yet. And yet they still did a suicide mission in the heart of the nation to basically show, we hate everything you stand for. That's the movement that created President Sharaa. That's the movement that created all those people under him. And this is the government that President Trump is helping normalize in the eyes of the West of the world and even sponsor. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on as President Trump helps integrate Syria into the community of nations and as the new government in Syria gets its feet on the ground. That's not the only story of a terrorist or somebody belonging to a terrorist group being invited to a Western capital. The day after President Sharaa was in Washington, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, was in Paris on invitation from French President Emmanuel Macron. This is the first time he has visited France since France recognized a Palestinian state a couple of months ago. So this time he was coming officially as stated by the French government, as president of the state of Palestine. And some big news there about what they accomplished. President Macron had a joint press conference with him where they announced France and the PA would establish a, quote, joint committee for the consolidation of the state of Palestine, end quote, which would, further down, quote, contribute to drawing up a new constitution, a draft of which President Abbas had presented to me, end quote, speaking of Macron. Small statements, but a lot to take in there. Consolidation of the state of Palestine. What does that mean? Well, the Palestinian Authority hasn't governed Gaza since 2007. Now that the war in Gaza is close to being over, they're basically saying, France is saying, we're going to help bring Gaza into the PA's authority. Except Israel has ruled that out. They said, no, we don't want the PA. The PA is corrupt. The PA helped cause this problem of radicalism with the Palestinians. We don't like that. And Israel governs half of Gaza. Israel controls the blockade and the coast. France is basically saying, we're going to do everything we can to twist Israel's arm into getting the PA into Gaza. And even think about it, the Constitution. France is literally helping draft the Palestinian Constitution. And when you put all these things together, France is quickly becoming the PA's most important sponsor, at least in the Western world. Now, maybe Abbas doesn't have the same baggage Sharrah has, but he still belongs to a terror group, the PLO, the guys that Yasser Arafat used to be leading and attacking Israel for decades and decades. Abbas was Arafat's deputy. Since he's become the leader of the PA in 2004, he's been serving, what, for over 20 years now in his inaugural four-year term. He'll turn 90 tomorrow. He turned the West Bank into half of it into a kleptocracy, which he uses as his personal fiefdom, and the other half is ungovernable. Even with his security forces, he can't go in and establish law and order. Just Hamas and other terror groups run rampant there. It's his government that pays terrorists, including terrorists by Hamas, that are in Israeli prisons right now. He helps bankroll them and their families. It's his government that, with the United Nations, basically governs Palestinian school curricula, publishes textbooks and other material that teaches young Palestinian children to hate Jews, to grow up, to be terrorists. It's the kind of stuff we've seen in Gaza that's been exposed in Gaza that led up to October 7th. There's, of course, the Al-Quds Brigades, Fatah's militant wing. That's the particular faction Abbas belongs to. It's questionable exactly how much authority he has over them. But again, his party, Fatah, has connections to a terror group that participated in the October 7th massacre. The rest of Psalm 83 talks about the Philistines, or the people that used to live in Gaza today being part of this alliance. Mr. Fleury has said that means we're going to see the Palestinians put in this too. And later it mentions Asher, or Assyria, the modern name, or the ancestral name of Germany, being in this as well. And we expect Germany to be a major player in this alliance, but Germany belongs to the EU. It leads the EU, and we expect the rest of Europe to have some connection with this as well. So when you see France becoming the Palestinian Authority as one of its most important sponsors, that is definitely a trend in light of Psalm 83 and other prophecies to keep your eyes on.
We should emphasize, you know, when we're talking about this being fulfilled Bible prophecy, this isn't us looking back after the event and cherry-picking a few verses out of context, like you'll see the media do sometimes, and then say, well, see, this is like, Mr. Fleury wrote articles saying this is what is going to happen based on Bible prophecy before it happened. We've watched this happen, and with Syria especially, we've watched this happen over the last 2 or 3 years. And we're going to, it's actually just the last 12 months or so, it's changed that dramatically. And we've got more changes now that we're saying, watch for these changes. And so this is about more than just Middle East news. This is about seeing God's power in world events and God's power to deliver America from its problems, to deliver any nation from its problems if they turn to him. So thank you for that, Mihailo. Did you have any other Middle Eastern stories before we let you go?
Just one more story. On Tuesday, Iraq held parliamentary elections. Yes, they technically are a democracy and they have a parliament. It's not a rubber stamp parliament like in most of the Middle East, amazingly enough. The incumbent prime minister, Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, won. the most amount of votes, but they expect it's going to take a few months to create a coalition. That doesn't mean there weren't some shakeups there, though. The Islamic Dawah Party, led by former PM Nouri al-Maliki, you may remember him if you've been watching Iraq for a while, they did better than expected. They're backed by Iran. They want to bring an Iran-style Islamic revolution of sorts to Iraq. And Sudani himself, he's considered by most analysts to be not under Iran's thumb, like, say, these other guys, but he's no friend to the U.S. either. He helped, it was under his first term where the U.S. agreed to withdraw from Iraq. That hasn't been completed yet. And even when he was running the first time, he was sponsored by Iran's Shiite militias in Iraq. You mentioned about Mr. Armstrong talking about these prophecies for a long time. You mentioned about how we've been talking about these prophecies for a long time. Those same prophecies I mentioned before, Psalm 83, Daniel 11, Mr. Fleury looked at those and determined that Iraq was going to fall to Iran. He said that in the 1990s when Saddam Hussein was at the apex of his power, when it was still an enemy of Iran, a powerful one at that. He said that when the U.S. invaded in 2003 and it looked like it would never become an American enemy again. It looked like the exact opposite of what would have happened, but events like this show Mr. Fleury was right. All those decades back, and we have an article we could put in the show notes, he was right about Iraq that shows why Mr. Fleury came to that conclusion and what we expect for Iraq in the future.
Well, it wasn't just bottles of cologne being handed out to terrorist leaders this week, though not having to pay out $10 million bounty for al-Shahara is perhaps a cost-saving for the United States. America's going to need a lot more of that if Donald Trump's going to fulfill his program. This week, we had the government shutdown end as the House and the Senate and then President Trump all approved spending to go on out again. And we've got some more spending projects on the horizon. So to get the latest on that, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yes, the longest government shutdown in United States history is now officially over. This government shutdown lasted 43 days, longer than it's ever gone before, and basically ended with a Republican capitulation to the Democrats. The reason the shutdown was going on in the first place is there were disagreements between the Republicans and the Democrats over how much the nation should be spending on Medicare and Medicaid. The Democrats obviously wanting to spend more than the Republicans had approved during their last budget. So since neither party had enough votes to get this a bill passed, they were at an impasse for the last 43 days until earlier this week, Senate Republicans promised to hold a vote on the Medicare package. Now, that vote's going to happen next month in December, but just the promise of the vote convinced six Democrats to vote with the Republicans to pass a temporary government funding measure that Donald Trump signed into law this week. That basically means the government now has enough funding to continue until the end of January.
And just to make clear, I understand this is a victory for the Republicans, right? Because the Democrats had been insisting we'll only refund the government if we get this healthcare spending that we want. And by exchanging that for, okay, we'll open the government for a vote in the Senate on the healthcare spending that we want, A, they're not necessarily going to win that vote. And then B, they've given up whatever leverage they would have had to have the House and to have President Trump approve the spending that they want. And even if the Senate were to vote yes, the House could vote it down. Donald Trump could veto it. So, I mean, is that how you see that this is the Democrats gave in to the Republicans on this story?
Yeah, I guess that those are all good points to bring up. I'll just be interested to see how the vote goes down. I was looking at it more that the Democrats did give in to the Republicans to pass a temporary financing bill to keep the government going in anticipation that they were going to do well in this vote. I mean, I guess they could have been outmaneuvered. I do think the bigger issue here I'd really like to bring to people's attention is that if the Democrats win this December vote, America's going to have an even bigger deficit. But even if the Republicans win it and they have their victory, their victory is still going to involve spending $1.8 trillion that they don't have. And so in this case, I didn't do the math before I came in, but I've done it in the past to where it's like a husband and wife that are hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt and like can barely afford their minimum credit card statement, arguing over whether they should go out to dinner this week. You probably shouldn't, but the amount of money you're going to spend on the dinner is so small compared to the actual problem. Because like this is really basically comes down to is the Republicans want to spend $1.8 trillion they don't have. The Democrats want to spend like $2 trillion or $2.1 trillion they don't have. So, and we'll find out in December which side wins. But either way, America has a huge spending problem on its hands. Because this budget deficit, you divide it out by the gross domestic product of the country, and it's like 6% of GDP. The economy is only growing like 2 to 3% of GDP. So the deficit's over twice as much as economic growth is, which means your debt to GDP ratio is going up. And that's the real problem. It's like you, at the bare minimum, like your debt can't grow faster than the gross domestic product because that ratio is what determines if you go into bankruptcy. And it's something that even if Republicans pull a victory out of this, they're not taking nearly seriously enough because now Donald Trump, he's definitely trying to package this as a victory. He's actually trying to package this as such a victory that he says he's looking at sending out $2,000 checks to people from the money we earn from tariffs. Which I think there's a lot of Americans, myself included, who can think of things that they do with $2,000. But the way President Trump is packaging this and the way he's talking about this on social media is he said, oh, we have so much tariff revenue pouring in that we're going to give everyone in America, except like the highest income people, $2,000. And then use the extra tariff revenue to pay down the national debt, which the math definitely does not support. So far, I think we've only collected about $215 million in tariff revenue.
Right, but some of those would have been collected anyway without Donald Trump's tariffs. Yeah, so the extra money that's been taken in is even smaller than that.
So if you took, yeah, based on the total tariff revenue, there's about 130-something million households in America. You might have enough money to give $2,000 to every household. You wouldn't have enough money to give $2,000 to every person. The catch there is, like, even if you've got enough money to give the $2,000 to every household, you still don't have anything left over to pay off the national debt. I did look at this math, and there's some academic debates over exactly how much money is even possible to collect via tariffs. I think the general consensus I found is that once you pass a 50% effective tariff on all foreign imports, that'd be about twice as much as there is now. People just stop buying foreign imports and you actually make less money. So raising tariffs only raises revenue to a point. Once you hit about 50%, people just stop buying the good and the money starts going back down. And so based on that number, they calculate that the maximum amount of money America could collect from tariffs is probably about $750 million a year. If you try to collect more than that, it just doesn't work because people just stop buying foreign goods completely. So that number, $750 million, would be enough money to give every man, woman, and child in America $2,000. But you wouldn't be paying off the national debt. In fact, if you didn't give any tariff rebates. You sent everyone a $0 check and just used, ramped the tariffs up as high as they could go and used all the money to pay off the national debt. You still would only bring the deficit down to about spending $1 trillion every year you wouldn't have. So the tariff money wouldn't even make up for the deficit. It might get the deficit close to the point where it's only growing at 3%, so your debt to GDP ratio doesn't change. But I guess to make a long story short, it's like America is going to go bankrupt unless its debt to GDP ratio stops going up. There's a lot of debates over exactly when it will go bankrupt, but I think Warren Buffett put it the simplest. He said, if something can't go on forever, it will stop. So your debt to GDP ratio can't keep going up forever. And to stop it from going up, you have to cut at least $1 trillion from government spending. Or get $1 trillion in additional taxes. So right now, bringing in $200 million in tariff revenue a year, and as you pointed out, that's not even new tariffs, that's just all tariffs. That's only getting you a fraction to where you need to be. So when Donald Trump says he's going to send everyone a $2,000 check and use the rest to pay off the national debt, he's just outright lying. He's saying that to drum up support for tariffs, and there are pros and cons to tariffs. America is pretty reliant on foreign nations for a lot of things. But if you're using it as like a revenue system, it's like the amount of money he's bringing in with tariffs is less than half of what he needs to stop America's debt to GDP ratio from going up. And so sending that money out in $2,000 checks to American citizens, it's a populist move that will make a lot of MAGA people like him, but it's extremely fiscally irresponsible. There was one of the big financial groups in America held a think tank this week over what we can do about the national debt, and one of the speakers, Richard Haass, yeah, he's a president emeritus at the Council of Foreign Relations, used the phrase that America spent its rainy day fund in sunny times. And I thought that was really struck right at the heart of the problem.
And part of the reason why America gets into all of this trouble is debt is seen as good, as a tool, maybe not good, but a tool that is good under the right circumstances. Whereas, you know, God looks at debt very differently. The Bible talks about debt being a curse. It talks about it being morally wrong to borrow and then not pay back. You know, ancient Israel, when God set up their financial system, he didn't want people loaning debt at interest. They were allowed to charge interest to other countries just so they didn't get taken advantage of. But under his system, it wasn't built on debt. Whereas today, we're all built on debt. And now, so much of government, personal debt, auto debt, there is debt everywhere. And that debt is a prophesied curse.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really good point, is that you can read the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, and you will never find a single statement saying anything good about debt. It's not necessarily a sin. It's a sin if you borrow and with no plan to pay it back, which is the position America's in. So you can actually say that America's national debt is actively sinful, because you're borrowing money it knows it can never pay back. If you can pay it back, like a mortgage or even an auto loan or something like that, you borrow money for something that you can pay back, that's not sinful. But just because it's not sinful doesn't mean it's a positive thing. The Bible never describes it as a positive thing. Best case scenario is you're a servant. It says the borrower is servant to the lender. So I have a mortgage. I can afford the mortgage payment. I have a plan to pay it back. Not wrong for me to have that. But you miss one of those mortgage payments and you'll find out very quickly who your master is. It's your mortgage company. And they'll be very good at reminding you of that you are not a free man. You have signed an indentured servitude contract with them. Now, America as a nation, as the wealthiest nation as a whole, should not be in debt to foreign nations, because it's like, yeah, we've borrowed money from Japan and from China and other nations that have actually put us in a position of like subservience to them. And when, as America's debt to GDP ratio goes up, and it eventually does go bankrupt, like when you miss a mortgage payment and you find out who your master is, America's going to find out who its foreign masters are. Actually, the relevant prophecy here that I usually go to is in Deuteronomy 28, where it says that if you turn away from God's laws as a nation, then others will lend to you, but you will not lend to others. And then the very next verse says the stranger will get up very high and you'll get down very low. Just highlighting the fact that we're in debt to other nations puts us in a position of servitude towards those nations. And then as you continue on through Deuteronomy 28, it starts out with a national debt that causes foreign peoples to get up high above America. But then it ends with a foreign power, particularly says a nation whose tongue you don't understand. They speak a foreign language. They come here quick as an eagle flies, is the phrase they use in Deuteronomy, and actually start enslaving the American people, basically taking what we owe them in assets. And so some pretty sobering verses here that end with war and slavery and financial bondage that really kind of all starts with others lending to you and you not lending to others. That's why one of the reasons we've pointed so far that like the we've called America's financial collapse the late Herbert W. Armstrong's greatest personal prophecy. Or actually specific that he said that America's financial collapse would be the catalyst that causes the nations of Europe to unite into a super state. Now, there's prophecies in Deuteronomy about America's financial collapse, and there's prophecies in Revelation 17 and elsewhere about Europe uniting into a super state. Now, the fact that the financial collapse is the catalyst that causes Europe to unite is Herbert W. Armstrong's greatest personal prophecy, because the Bible does not explicitly say that the financial collapse, which is prophesied, will cause the superstate, which is also prophesied. It's just linking two prophecies together in a way that he thought it would happen, and it looks like he was right on the money there, because now you've got bankers in Europe who see America's debt to GDP ratio getting high, and they're talking about euro bonds and other ways to position as the euro as the reserve currency, things that they would not be talking about if America's debt to GDP ratio was lower. So you definitely see European leaders talking the way Mr. Armstrong said they were. They're like, well, because America's got all these financial problems, and they'd rather send out $2,000 checks to everybody than fix them, we have to start taking steps to unite into a military superpower.
Sobering look at America's debt problem. Thank you for that, Andrew. Were there any other stories you wanted to bring to us from the English-speaking world?
Yeah, a couple other big America stories. I think you guys have already talked about the Trump hosting the Al-Qaeda terrorist in the White House, which was big news in the United States here this week. We also got some more sobering revelations into the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. I think we talked about him in this program a couple weeks ago, particularly in regards to his ties with Prince Andrew in Britain, something that's caused Prince Andrew to lose many of his royal titles. Well, now we're actually finding out that the Barack Obama was actually in pretty close contact with Jeffrey Epstein during his second term for a really kind of sinister reason. You're looking at these emails between Jeffrey Epstein himself before he died and members of the Obama administration, where all the emails are about whether Donald Trump had any connection to Epstein. But not in a way that, like, oh, he's legitimately concerned. It's in a way like, okay, this is a political rival. Do you have any dirt on him? And then you've got one of the emails coming back where, like, their primary witness against Prince Andrew, Virginia Gruffé, they're actually complaining that she's had a bunch to say about other world leaders, but nothing to say about Donald Trump. Which shows you why these this connection between Epstein and Obama was so so sinister. Because if he was legitimately trying to expose the Epstein scandal, there'd be a lot more in these emails like, okay, well, instead of complaining about Virginia not saying anything incriminating of Trump, how about we focus on all the people that Virginia did have incriminating evidence on? And these emails we've seen so far, there's really not much about the people they do have evidence on.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Well, of course, the United States is not the only country that people are talking about or questioning their financial solvency. And in fact, there's probably more questions asked about Russia. Is Vladimir Putin's regime on the brink of going bankrupt? There's been new sanctions on oil companies, and there's lots of talk as to about how hard these are biting. Russia has, of course, been spending a lot of money, borrowing a lot of money for its war in Ukraine. So to understand what is going on here, and if Russia is really about to go into financial collapse, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. We've been hearing quite a lot of doomsaying lately about the Russian economy. Just quite a few economists and other onlookers saying that it's just about to collapse. And on one hand, you can see why more and more onlookers are kind of looking upon the Russian economy with a jaundiced eye. We are now almost 45 months into this so-called three-day war, and you've got 1.1 million personnel losses for Russia. You've also got maybe as much as $300 billion that Russia has spent on this so far. This has led to very high inflation, and the purchasing power of the Russian people is significantly eroded. And then at the same time, the U.S. has lifted Biden-era restrictions on American weapon systems inside of Ukraine. So this has enabled the Ukrainians to destroy quite a lot of Russian energy infrastructure, including some that's deep inside of Russia. From what we can tell, these strikes have taken out maybe as much as 25% of Russia's refining capacity. So quite significant there. And then the U.S. also sanctioned, as you mentioned a moment ago, two of Russia's largest oil firms last month, including secondary sanctions that carry with them the threat of blocking any organization that does business with those two companies from U.S. Capital markets. Now, we have seen China and India find some creative loopholes and workarounds, but it's still reducing the amount of Russian energy that they buy. And that Russian energy is the very backbone of the country's economy. So the doomsaying about the Russian economy, it is easy to understand, but what those who are predicting collapse fail to grasp is that war economies, which the Russian economy now is, are fundamentally unlike the peacetime systems that they are accustomed to analyzing. So a war economy, as the name implies, it just means an economy that is focused on sustaining the military effort. It means the nation's priorities are no longer about serving the needs of the people, but instead are about serving the demands of the war. And that's where Russia is. It is a war economy. And you know, over the long term, that's not going to be viable. War, by its very nature, causes death and destruction, and that weakens a country's long-term economic foundations. But war also brings massive amounts of government spending. It brings big surges in production. It brings great amounts of industrial innovation and retooling. It also brings unemployment way down. So in the short term, for several years, a nation operating under a war economy can undergo significant GDP growth. You can look back in the World War II era and you can see that for powers as diverse as Russia and the Soviet Union and Britain and the United States. And then it's also true right now for Russia today. Russia's growth so far into the war has been strong, actually stronger even than some of Europe's main economies in Germany and in the UK. And there was an analysis by economist Joe Schafsfurt a few days back, and basically he is taking a close examination of the four main causes that generally bring about economic collapse. And he shows that Russia appears to be largely insulated from all four of these risks. So currency crash is one of the big four. But Russia has safeguarded against this by introducing capital controls. And then another major cause of collapse is economic blockade. We saw that with Germany in World War I. And most nations would fear an economic blockade because they know that they are dependent on the inputs that they bring in from other nations. But Russia is the world's largest country with vast resources. And when those resources are placed alongside its stalwart trading partners, such as China and India, it's clear that Russia is not particularly vulnerable to a collapse due to a disruption of inputs. Number three is debt. Excessive debt has tanked many economies over the years, and Russian debt is growing as a result of the war. But if you look at the actual numbers, you see that debt, both government debt and household, are still remarkably low, especially when you compare them to many of the far more profligate Western economies right now. So a debt-driven collapse at present is very unlikely for Russia. And then the last one of the big four factors is public morale, or, you know, the threat of a populace that gets tired of the situation and ends up rising up against it and thereby collapsing it. But the situation in Russia today shows that public opinion is tremendously high. It's actually near record levels, despite the inflation, despite the very real hardship that many of the people are enduring. And Vladimir Putin knows this. And he knows that even if more suffering sets in, he can afford to let it slide quite a bit before the morale reaches a level that could pose a bit of a threat to him. So it all shows that as much as we may wish for a Russian economic collapse, as much as we may wish for the Russians to be humbled and to no longer to be able to, you know, terrorize nations and undermine the stability of the global order, it does not look like it'll happen anytime soon. They can probably keep the war machine humming for another 2 years, possibly even longer, depending on how much assistance they receive from China and other partner nations. So the Russian economy is not about to collapse. Putin and his government are not about to be replaced. And this would come as no surprise to Trumpet readers, because Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has long maintained that Vladimir Putin is a man who is specifically mentioned in biblical prophecy. You can look at Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39 to see the passages there that are mainly about that. And these passages show that really he's just getting started. And his most destructive and most consequential wars lie still ahead. Mr. Flurry's booklet on this topic is called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. It takes a deep dive into those chapters and related passages and just shows how Putin is the man being described here. So for anyone who would like to understand that and to understand why the Russian economy is not about to collapse, I hope you'll order your free copy of The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And then I also wanted to talk about a couple of smaller stories here out of Asia. First up, the Chinese government placed a bounty on the heads of two Taiwanese citizens this week. These Taiwanese individuals are not criminals. They are Instagram influencers. but they are proud Taiwanese citizens, and they sometimes speak about the importance of keeping their country free from the grip of the Chinese Communist Party. And of course, the Chinese Communist Party leaders hate to hear that because they are hell-bent on seizing Taiwan. So now these two influencers have bounties on their heads, $35,000 each, if they are turned over to the Chinese. So it's just another chilling reminder of the way the Chinese Communist Party leaders think that they are essentially emperors of the whole world, and of how determined they are to assert their will and to achieve their dark ambitions in Taiwan and beyond. And then the last story that I wanted to mention is about India. India is not sending soldiers to fight in Russia's war, but it is sending men to work jobs in Russia that Russian men are no longer doing since they are in Ukraine fighting the war. So Russia has been suffering some fairly severe labor shortages as a result of the war. They just don't have enough people to do all the jobs. But the nation of India, on the other hand, has a great abundance of people. It is the world's most populous nation now. So Vladimir Putin is heading to India next month to meet with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And we learned this week that the two of them will be signing a pact that clears the way for India to send 70,000 workers into Russia to work a whole range of jobs. So even though this isn't direct military assistance from India, it still shows a very deep level of cooperation between Russia and India. And it shows that Putin's power over the nations of Asia, including a nation like India that's supposed to be sort of West-leaning, is growing stronger.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Well, Germany hit some very important milestones this week. It was a very big week for anniversaries. The November 9th is a massive day in German history. It was the anniversary of the proclamation of the Weimar Republic in 1918. It was also the anniversary of the pogroms against the Jews in 1938. And in some ways was the start of the Holocaust, and then was the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. Germany's President Frank-Walter Steinmeier gave a speech on the occasion asking, "Is it possible that we have not learned the lesson of history? November 9th represents light and shadow, the deepest abysses and the happiest hours of our history," he said. And he said that November 9th, 1918, that anniversary of the Weimar Republic, will always remind us of how precious peace and democracy are, and that once hard won, they are never guaranteed for all time. So some important milestones, and another important milestone came just three days later on November 12th. November 12th was the 70th anniversary of the German army, the foundation of the Bundeswehr. And a brief comment from Deutsche Welle points to a story of massive significance to November 9th, 1989, and the fall of the Berlin Wall and of the Bundeswehr and that anniversary. And they wrote, and they began, this is how they began their article on the founding of the German military. "In 1945, few would have predicted that Germany would reestablish an army just a decade later." Well, you know who did predict that? Herbert W. Armstrong. I mean, we started this episode talking about fulfilled prophecy. And again, prophecy that's not kind of fulfilled in hindsight and somebody looking back and finding some tenuous link in the Bible to something that just happened and saying, "Oh, the Bible forecast this." No, this is people looking in the Bible and saying, "Hey, the Bible says this is going to happen." And then that event happening years later. So in 1945, Mr. Armstrong forecast that Germany would rise from the rubble. He said, "And this round of war in Europe is over, and the Nazis have now gone underground." And he talked about how Germany would plan to come right back, to rise back up. And he said how that would happen based on Bible prophecy. It would be a resurrected Roman Empire, a European Union. Those were his exact words. 1945, he said, Germany's going to rise back up, and it's going to happen as part of a European Union. And now we see Germany leading and dominating the European Union. So yes, few could have predicted. It was astonishing. It would have been an astonishing prediction for somebody in 1945 to say, well, Germany's going to come back and very soon they'll have a military. Mr. Armstrong made that prediction. And as part of that prediction, he said that this European Union, this kind of resurrected Roman Empire, it's going to include nations from Western Europe and Eastern Europe. And the Catholic Church is going to play an important role in making that happen and in bringing East and West together. And that's a prophecy that was fulfilled on November 9th, 1989. Germany reunited. East Germany, very right away, as they reunite with Germany, well, they're part of the European Union. And then the rest of Eastern Europe coming into the European Union, exactly the way Mr. Armstrong said that it would. You know, there's years of forecasting there. 1981, his plain truth magazine said, it is prophesied some of these Balkan nations are yet to throw off the Soviet yoke and realign themselves with the Pope. As long as the churches are still functioning and the people still attend them, the only change being their submission to Moscow and their separation from Rome, there is the possibility of an internal political coup brought about by underground Catholic influence, which can restore their tie to Rome. Do not underestimate or sell short Catholic power, strategy, and resourcefulness. He's talked about the Balkans coming back and said, well, maybe it will happen during a coup. That was that Plain Truth article. It didn't quite happen that way, but you've got several Balkan nations now, part of the European Union, and the Catholic Church played a major role in the breakup of Yugoslavia and in recognizing they led the world, the Vatican and Germany led the world in recognizing the independence of Croatia. April 1952, good news. Russia may give East Germany back to the Germans and will be forced to relinquish her control over Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and parts of Austria to complete the 10-nation union, this coming economic union. 1955, Mr. Armstrong said, some of the Balkan nations are going to tear away from behind the Iron Curtain. Russia has lost already, to all appearances, Tito's Yugoslavia. Russia probably will lose still more of her Eastern European satellites. And all of this happened exactly as Mr. Armstrong forecast. 1957, when the right psychological moment arrives, a number of those Eastern European nations will break away from Moscow. Very specific forecasts, proven exactly true. And this week we also had some important milestones that tie into the rise of the German military. So the German government finally got their new kind of sort of on the way to conscription law and compromise passed, where all 18-year-old men in Germany will have to sign a questionnaire, they'll have to undertake a medical examination, and then those that are deemed good candidates will be encouraged to join the military. But if they don't get enough people to join the military that way, then they agreed in the coalition that they'll then pursue a subsequent law to enact conscription. All of this aiming to boost Germany's military by 44% to 260,000 over the next decade or so. And as part of this reorganization, Politico had a really good, important article titled Germany's Rearmament Upends Europe's Power Balance. I mean, they were making the point that we've made a few times on this show that historically, Germany is the economic powerhouse of Europe, and it's France and a few others that kind of provide the European leadership. But Germany being by far the biggest military spender as well as the economic power changes everything. They write, as Germany aims to become Europe's predominant military power, the political balance is shifting. In France, there's a scramble to stay relevant, while in Poland, Germany's rearmament is stirring old ghosts and creating a sense that a Berlin-Warsaw alliance might be the most effective way to keep Russia at bay. You know, Poland and others are not sure quite how to handle this. It says one EU official called the shift in Germany's military potential telluric, or earth-moving. Another diplomat put it more directly, it is the most important thing happening right now at EU levels. They point out that by the end of the decade, 2029, 2030, Germany is forecast to be spending 153 billion euros on defense, while France would be spending 80 billion. So this is not Germany has just slightly overtaken France. I mean, that's the way it was like a year or two ago. They're on course to be spending double what France is spending. Double what the traditional military leader of the EU is spending. It is a massive shift. The article concludes with one EU diplomat saying, it could be frightening, no doubt. Yeah, it could be frightening. He then goes on to say, but Germany has coalitions, it's the EU and NATO, and many things could happen in the meantime. But the same source that Mr. Armstrong used to forecast the fall of the Berlin Wall and used to say in 1945, Germany's going to rearm, you're going to see a German army once again. Well, now Deutsche Welle itself will say, well, nobody really could have predicted that in 1945. The same source that Mr. Armstrong used to make those accurate predictions says Germany's going to turn on the United States. Germany is, I mean, breaking with NATO, puts it mildly. Germany's going to bring down and play a massive, they're going to lead Europe in bringing down the United States, and they're going to work with China to do it. And ultimately, America is going to become captive to Germany. And yeah, that's a bold forecast. Just like saying Germany's going to rearm while it lay in rubble in 1945 was a bold forecast. But that is based on Bible prophecy. That is what is coming, and that is from the sure word of your Bible. And the good news there, of course, is that the Bible is a sure word. You can rely on it. You can depend on it. It has the sure solution for America to avoid that, for Britain to avoid that, for France to avoid being part of this German combine. It has the sure word for individuals to be protected and to lead a happy and abundant life. The Bible is a book very relevant for the modern world. It tells you how to live, how to be happy, how to run a marriage, a family, a country, how to look to and turn to God. It's a Bible prophecy shows that God rules in the kingdom of men, that we live in Satan's world, and that Satan has been cast down, and there's a lot of evil there. But God has a plan. God is in charge overall. God has the power to protect his people. He has the power to intervene in world events. And we can learn and get to know him through the powerful words of his Bible. And I'll just finish by pointing to our free book, He Was Right. We're getting this ready to go out, a new updated version out to the printers, because of course, you know, Mr. Armstrong made these forecasts, and you know, when he died in 1986, there were a lot of those forecasts that were unfulfilled. You know, people could have scoffed and said, well, Germany's still divided. Eastern Europe is still part of the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union. It hasn't happened. Well, it hadn't happened yet. And so every few years, we come back and update this book as more and more of those forecasts that God inspired Mr. Armstrong to make are fulfilled, are proven true. There's more evidence with each year, with each month, that God was revealing biblical truth through Mr. Armstrong. And so we've got an updated version of that book that I'm not sure how long it will take to get from the printers, but you can read the version that we have right now that is still a few years out of date on our website, thetrumpet.com. But you can order your own free print copy and we'll get the updated version to you as soon as it's out from the printers. That is He Was Right, and we can put a link to that in our show notes. It is, of course, like everything that we produce, free and sent to you with no cost or obligation. There's no follow-up. We're not going to chase you for donations or anything like that. We just want to get the truth of the Bible out to the largest audience possible. Well, thank you very much for listening today. Thank you to all of our contributors. Thank you to George Haddad and Jacob Hessong for engineering and production. We'll be back with our regular show next week. And until then, keep watching your world.